relationship in the areas of communication, time together, money, work, parenting, and sexuality. Then they post this statement where they will see and read it every day. 2. Focus on what you like about your partner more than what you don't like. Many people with low prefrontal cortex activity seek conflict as a way to stimulate themselves, even inadvertently. The problem with focusing on negative behavior is that you drive the other person away. The negativity kills the relationship. 3. Positive stimulation is helpful. Look for new, exciting ways to stimulate the relationship. The prefrontal cortex seeks stimulation. It is important to have new, exciting, stimulating experiences to keep the relationship fresh and alive. Look for ways to do new things together, such as sharing a hobby, going to new places, or spicing up your sex life. 4. Learn to say, "I'm sorry." Admitting mistakes and saying you're sorry is essential to relational health. When the prefrontal cortex doesn't work hard enough, people don't have access to good internal supervision, and they may say or do things impulsively. When that happens, it is important to apologize and let your partner know you're sorry. Unfortunately, many people aren't good at saying they are sorry, and they try to justify why they did or said hurtful things. Learn to apologize and take responsibility for your mistakes. 5. Then what? Think about what you say or do before you say or do it. Thoughtfulness and forethought are essential to effective relationships. Before you say or do something in a relationship, ask yourself if what you say or do fits with the goals you have for the relationship. Will your behavior help or hurt the relationship? Supervising your thoughts and actions is essential to relational health. Prefrontal cortex, relational prescriptions for partner. 1. Don't be your partner's stimulant. Because the prefrontal cortex seeks stimulation, many partners unconsciously seek stimulation in a negative way. Without knowing it, they unconsciously try to upset you. They try to get you to yell. They try to make you angry. It is very important to have a calm demeanor when you notice this is happening. Do whatever you can to not yell or become emotionally intense. When you feel as if you're going to blow, take a breath or a break until you can get yourself under control. 2. Notice the positive. You change behavior by focusing on what you like a lot more than what you don't like. Often people with prefrontal cortex problems have low self-esteem and need encouragement and positive input from those they love. 3. Help your partner with organization. Disorganization is often a hallmark of prefrontal cortex problems. Rather than complain about the disorganization, it is generally much more effective to help your partner become more organized if he or she will allow you to. 4. Make the appointment and drive your partner to the doctor. Often, forgetfulness, procrastination, and denial accompany prefrontal cortex problems. Help may be put off for many years, even when it is obviously needed. Professional help can make a big difference in these problems, and I often see partners bring their loved ones in for evaluation and treatment. Don't wait for your partner to have the desire, will, or commitment to change. You may wait too long. 5. If medication is necessary, help your partner remember to take it. Do not do this in a condescending way, such as, "Did you take your medicine? Your behavior is way off." Instead, help your partner with a gentle, non-sarcastic reminder, or help your partner come up with a reminder system, such as weekly pill organizers or calendars. Anterior cingulate, relational prescriptions for self. 1. Notice when you are stuck. The first step in breaking negative cycles is for you to notice when you are in them. Being aware of repetitive negative patterns of behavior allows you to do something different. Notice these patterns when you have the same argument over and over, and find the courage to do something differently than you normally would. If you usually just go on and on trying to make your point, stop and say, "I'm finished. What's your perspective?" Then be quiet long enough to really hear what your partner is saying. 2. Take a break when things get heated. When you notice things are getting into a negative cingulate loop, take a break. When you notice tension in your voice, your body, or your conversation, find a way to distract yourself and take a break from the situation. 3. Stop nagging. Nagging erodes a relationship and needs to stop. Nagging, complaining about something over and over, is very common in cingulate people. It often has a serious negative impact on a relationship. When you find yourself going over the same material again and again, stop it. Beating someone over the head who is not listening to you is ineffective and irritating. Try to find new ways to deal with your frustrations. 4. Use good problem-solving techniques. When you are stuck at an impasse, writing down the issues that bother the relationship can often be very helpful. Use the following model. Write out the issue, such as spending too much money. Write out the options and solutions to the problem, spending less, budgeting, cutting up credit cards, and then choose among the options. Writing problems down often helps to get them out of your head and out of repetitive relational arguments. 5. Exercise together. Exercise enhances serotonin production in the brain and often helps a person, maybe even a couple, to become more flexible and less stuck on unhelpful behavior. 6. Have a smart carbohydrate snack. Smart carbs, such as sweet potatoes or hummus, often improve moods and help anterior cingulate people be more flexible. Low blood sugar often correlates with anger and irritability. Blood sugar voodoo. In one of the most fascinating studies, researchers measured the blood sugar levels of 107 married couples right before bedtime. Then they gave each spouse voodoo dolls and asked them to express their feelings about their partners by putting the pins in the dolls. The people who had the lowest blood sugar scores stuck more than twice the number of pins in their dolls. Protect your blood sugar levels. Your marriage, and maybe even your life, could depend on it. Anterior cingulate, relational prescriptions for partner. 1. Notice when your partner is stuck. The first step to breaking negative cycles is for couples to notice when they are in them. Being aware of negative repetitive patterns in your partner allows you to be helpful in the situation rather than inflame it. For example, if you notice your partner is not listening to you, but holding firmly onto his or her own position, take a breath and really try to listen to your partner. Do something different to break the negative cycle. 2. Take a break when things get heated. When you notice your partner is getting into a negative, anterior cingulate loop, change the pace. If you see your partner going over and over the same territory, or when his or her anger is escalating. Find a way to distract your partner or take a break from the situation. As I've said, one of the most helpful things I tell people to do is learn how to go into the bathroom when things get heated. 3. Deal effectively with nagging. Nagging may be caused by an overactive anterior cingulate, or it may arise because you're not listening to your partner. When someone has repetitive complaints about you, let him or her know you hear what they are saying. Ask your partner what steps you can take to make the situation better. Also, make it clear that you have heard about the issue and would appreciate not hearing about it again. In a kind way, ask what you can do to make that happen. 4. Exercise together. Exercise enhances serotonin production in the brain and often helps people be happier and more flexible. Temporal lobe, relational prescriptions for self. 1. Use memory helpers to keep the relationship fresh. Reminders can make all the difference between your partner knowing you care and feeling he or she is not important to you. Given the busy pace of our lives, we often forget to notice the people who are most special to us. Use notes, signs, computer reminder systems, ticklers, and so on to keep your attention focused on making the person you love feel loved. Flowers, limbic scents, cards, CDs, and loving notes to help your partner remember you love and care for him or her. Temporal lobe partners need constant reminders to keep you lovingly in their memory banks. 2. Listen to beautiful music together. Music is healing and often has a positive impact on relationships. As we have seen, music can enhance moods and sharpen learning and memory. Use beautiful music to enhance your connection to your partner. 3. Engage in rhythmic movement together. Dancing and walking hand in hand help maintain connection and promote bonding in a relationship. They provide rhythms that help to solidify memories of togetherness. 4. Remember the best times. Develop a positive sense of the history of the relationship. Reread loving cards and letters on a regular basis to maintain an overall happy sense of the relationship. 5. Deal effectively with anger. Practice effective anger management strategies like deep breathing, correcting negative thoughts, and clear communication. In addition, be sure to stay away from alcohol and drugs. They can unleash a vulnerable temporal lobe, uncorking anger and causing serious problems. 6. Know you have a tendency to be extremely sensitive to the behavior of others. Mild paranoia often accompanies a temporal lobe problem. When you feel others are being negative toward you, don't automatically believe your negative thoughts or feelings. Check them out. 7. Protein snacks may be helpful. Often stabilizing blood sugar with a protein snack, nuts, lean meat, hard-boiled eggs, helps to settle down a situation caused by temporal lobe irregularities. Temporal lobe relational prescriptions for partner. 1. Do not take this problem personally. Often people with temporal lobe problems struggle in relationships because of their negativity, anger, and mild paranoia. Help your partner see situations clearly, but do not take the negativity personally. 2. Take anger seriously. Sometimes temporal lobe rage can get out of control. If you see your partner escalating, do not worsen the situation further, especially if substance abuse is involved. Talk in a soft voice, take a break, actively listen. Offering food may also help. Do not use addictive substances around the temporal lobe partner. The more you use, the more likely your partner will use, and things can get really out of control. 3. Keep protein snacks around. 4. Make sure to get your partner to the doctor if the temporal lobe problems interfere with functioning. Such problems are often very treatable. Use these prescriptions to enhance the love in your life. Love makes life worth living. Chapter 18. The Missing Links. Drugs, alcohol, head trauma, toxins, infections, and the brain. When my work with SPECT began in 1991, I was the director of a psychiatric hospital unit that took care of patients with drug and alcohol addictions. Compared to healthy brains, the scans of addicts generally looked awful. They showed significantly low activity and had a Swiss cheese or moth-eaten appearance on the 3D images. In fact, they looked so bad, I brought the pictures home to my children, effectively inducing anxiety disorders in all of them as it related to substance abuse. On my children's mother's side, there is a significant family history of alcoholism. I told my kids, if you never drink, you'll never have a problem. But if you drink, you may have a very big problem. And this may be the brain that awaits you, as I showed them the brain-damaged images. Which brain do you want? I would ask. They answered that they wanted the healthy ones, and despite their genetic vulnerability, none of them have ever had a problem. The pictures were so powerful that my son Anthony brought them to school, which caused quite a discussion among his friends and teachers. He planted the seed for our poster, Which Brain Do You Want?, which has healthy scans in the center, surrounded by drug-affected scans. The poster now hangs in hundreds of thousands of schools, prisons, drug treatment centers, therapists' offices, businesses, and courts around the world. You might recall the This Is Your Brain on Drugs public service commercial that showed eggs being cracked into a pan. Well, these spec pictures showed the devastation to real brains and were even more powerful. One judge in Cleveland has purchased thousands of posters to give away to addicts who appear in his courtroom. In my work, I've discovered that spec scans are an incredibly useful tool in getting addicts to stop substance abuse. The scans gave them brain envy. Robert, age 39, came to see me because he thought he had ADD. He was forgetful, disorganized, and impulsive, and had a very short attention span. However, these problems had come on gradually during his adult life, not during childhood. Most notably, he also had a 20-year history of heroin abuse and had been in multiple treatment settings without success. It is hard to describe how I felt when I initially saw Robert's spec study. This man was about my age, yet his brain looked 50 years older and with a toxic dementia-like appearance. When I showed Robert his spec study, compared to one of a healthy brain, he was horrified. Even though he had tried unsuccessfully to stop abusing heroin on many occasions, this time he went into treatment and was able to stop. Later he told me, it was either heroin or my brain. I wasn't giving any more of my brain to the drug. In my experience, inhalants such as gasoline, paint thinners, nail polish remover, and nitrous oxide, laughing gas, cause the most brain damage. Cocaine and high-dose methamphetamines, which can increase psychosis, agitation, and depression, are not far behind. People with ADD often self-medicate with methamphetamines. Of course, because the dosages are unregulated, many people seriously damage their brains and lives. Opiates can depress overall brain function, which is why I encourage my patients to try everything else for chronic pain relief, such as acupuncture and hypnosis, before depending on opiate drugs. Benzodiazepines, commonly used for anxiety, decrease brain function. Cigarette smoking also damages the brain. A 2015 study found that smoking's association with dementia and cognitive decline is caused by the thinning of the cortex. In other words, it causes brain cells to die. People ask me about all sorts of things on social media, but I've noticed that one of the most common questions I get is about the safety and effects of marijuana. In scanning thousands of marijuana users over the years, it is clear that this plant powerfully impacts the brain. Over time, it clearly gives the brain a toxic appearance in many users. Marijuana significantly lowers brain activity, and I've seen it decrease memory, motivation, learning, focus, and coordination. In young people, it also increases the risk of psychosis. According to the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, marijuana can lead to a drop in IQ by 8 points and is linked to lower educational outcomes, with users less likely to graduate from high school or college, who have a lower overall satisfaction with life, who are more likely to earn a lower income or be unemployed. People who come to our clinics report that it makes them feel less socially anxious and sometimes less depressed, which is why they use it. But chronic recreational use clearly takes its toll and outweighs any benefit in the moment. In one study on veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, researchers tested marijuana as a treatment. Results showed that marijuana use was actually significantly associated with higher PTSD symptom severity, as well as higher levels of violent behavior and alcohol and drug use. Is marijuana worse than alcohol or some legal prescription drugs such as Xanax or Valium? Not really, in my experience. None of them are good for your brain over the long term. Should we incarcerate pot users? That doesn't seem like a good idea, to warehouse people in a chronically stressful environment with terrible nutrition and a peer group that clearly won't elevate them. Head trauma and alcohol don't mix. John, a 79-year-old contractor, had a long-standing history of alcohol abuse and violent behavior. He had physically abused his wife over 40 years of marriage and had been abusive to their children when they were young. Almost all of the abuse occurred when he was intoxicated. Then John underwent open-heart surgery. After the surgery, he had a psychotic episode that lasted 10 days. His doctor called me for a consult. I ordered a SPECT study as part of his evaluation, which showed markedly decreased activity in the left prefrontal cortex and left temporal lobe, a clear indication of a past head injury. When I asked John if he'd ever had any significant head injuries, John said, "By golly, I did. When I was 20 years old, I was driving a milk truck that was missing its side rearview mirror. When I put my head out of the window to look behind me, my head smacked into a pole, knocking me unconscious for several hours." After the head injury, he had problems with his temper and memory. There was a family history of alcohol abuse in 4 of his 5 brothers, although none of his brothers had problems with aggressive behavior. Given the location of his brain abnormality, left prefrontal cortex and temporal lobe, John was vulnerable to exhibiting violent behavior. Alcohol abuse, which did not elicit violent behavior in his brothers, contributed to John's violence. If John had seen and understood his brain damage earlier, he could have sought help and prevented the devastation to his family. Father and son study. I believe all people in a domestic violence situation could benefit from knowing about their brains. 9-year-old Philip was frightened when the police came to his school to talk with him. His teacher had noticed bruises on his arms and legs and called Child Protective Services. Philip wasn't sure if he should tell them the truth, that his father, Dennis, had beaten him up, or if he should say that he had fallen down a flight of stairs, or something like that. Philip did not want to get his dad into trouble, and he felt responsible for the beatings he received. After all, he thought his father had told him 10 times to clean his room, but for some reason unknown to Philip, he hadn't done it. Philip and his father often fought, but it had never been apparent to people outside the home. Philip decided to tell the truth, which led his family to get help. The court ordered counseling for the family and a psychiatric evaluation for Dennis, who was found to be impulsive and explosive in many different situations. He had begun to have problems after sustaining a head injury in a car accident 6 years earlier. His wife reported that when Philip was first born, Dennis was loving, patient, and attentive. After the accident, he had become irritable, distant, and angry. In family counseling sessions, Philip was very difficult, restless, overactive, impulsive, and defiant. He ignored his parents' request to stop his annoying behaviors. I soon discovered that the interaction between Philip and his father was the problem, and counseling alone would not be helpful. I believed that there was some underlying biological or physical brain problem that contributed to the abusive interactions. In an effort to further understand the biology of this family's problems, I ordered brain speck studies on Philip and his father. The studies for both were abnormal. The father's clearly showed an area of increased activity in his left temporal lobe, probably a result of the car accident. Philip's revealed decreased activity in the front part of his brain when he tried to concentrate. As we have seen, this finding is often found in children who have ADD and are impulsive and overactive. After taking a history, watching the family interact, and reviewing the speck studies, it was clear to me that Phillips and his father's problems needed to be addressed in all four circles. Biological. I put Dennis on medicine to stabilize his temporal lobe and Philip on medicine for ADD, plus both on omega-3 fatty acids, exercise, which they did together, and a higher protein, lower carbohydrate diet, good for both of their brain types. Psychological. Therapy to deal with impulse control and alternatives to anger. Social. Training for Dennis on how to parent a challenging child based on my book, New Skills for Frazzled Parents. Spiritual. We discuss their sense of family and their mission for being on Earth. After about 6 months of intensive work, the family began to heal the wounds of abuse. In counseling sessions, Philip was calmer and more attentive, and his father was better able to learn how to deal with Philip's difficult behavior in a constructive way. Whenever abuse of a child occurs, it is a severe tragedy. The tragedy is compounded when the underlying brain problems that may be contributing to the abuse are ignored. Self-medicating Rusty. Many substance abusers use their drugs as a way to medicate underlying emotional or cognitive problems, such as depression, panic symptoms, post-traumatic stress, anxiety, and even aggressive behavior. 28-year-old Rusty was brought to see me by his parents. He had a severe methamphetamine problem that had wreaked havoc in his life. He was unable to keep steady work. He was involved in a physically abusive relationship with his girlfriend. He had been arrested 4 times for assault and battery. He was mean to his parents even though they tried to help him, and he had failed 5 drug treatment programs. In the last program, the counselor had recommended a tough love approach. He had told the parents to let Rusty hit bottom so that he would want help. The parents read about my work and decided to do one more thing before going the tough love route. Rusty's lack of responsiveness to traditional treatments made me suspect an underlying brain problem. We scheduled a SPECT scan with the parents, but Rusty didn't know about it until the morning he was supposed to have it. He showed up at the clinic loaded on high-dose methamphetamine from the night before. Rusty told me about his drug abuse. He said, "I'm sorry for messing up the scan. I'll come back next week. I promise I won't use anything." I had often wanted to do SPECT studies on people intoxicated with illegal substances to see their effects on the brain, but because of ethical concerns, I hadn't. But if a person shows up for the scan on drugs, there isn't an ethical concern. I decided to scan Rusty that morning with the effects of the methamphetamine still in his system, and then a week later off all drugs. It turned out to be a very fortuitous decision. When Rusty was under the influence of high-dose methamphetamine, his brain activity was suppressed. A week later, however, off all drugs, he had a terribly overactive left temporal lobe, probably causing his problems with violent behavior. Likely, Rusty was unconsciously self-medicating an underlying temporal lobe problem with high-dose methamphetamine. As I probed deeper into any history of a head injury, which initially both Rusty and his parents did not remember, Rusty recalled a time when he had been in second grade and had run full speed into a solid metal basketball pole and briefly been knocked unconscious. It's possible that set off a bad chain reaction in his brain. After the results of the clinical examination and brain SPECT studies, I put Rusty on the following 4 Circles program. Biological. Given his temporal lobe abnormality, I put him on carbamazepine, Tegretol, an anti-seizure medication to stabilize his temporal lobes, omega-3 fatty acids, and nutrients to help support brain repair, exercise, a higher protein, lower carbohydrate diet. Psychological, therapy to deal with his impulses. Social, counseling with his parents and an intensive outpatient program that taught him the importance of a new peer group if he was to stay sober. Spiritual, we discussed what gave Rusty a sense of meaning and purpose, and he decided to work toward being able to mentor others. Within 2 weeks, Rusty felt better than he had in years. He was calmer and his temper was under control. After a year, he was able to remain gainfully employed. An additional benefit of the scan was that I was able to show Rusty the serious damage he had been doing to his brain by abusing the methamphetamines. Even though the drugs helped his temporal lobe problem, they were clearly toxic to his brain. Rusty, like others who abused drugs, had developed holes in activity across the surface of his brain. Seeing these pictures was even more incentive to stay away from the drugs and get proper treatment for his problems. SPECT worked both as a powerful diagnostic tool to better assess one of the root causes of Rusty's problem and as a therapeutic tool to address his denial. A picture is worth a thousand denials. Often, having this type of information is valuable in helping patients make a more positive move towards sobriety. I wondered how many people with severe, non-responsive drug problems are self-medicating an underlying brain problem, yet are labeled by their families and society in general as weak-willed or morally defective. Tough love for Rusty wouldn't have solved his problem. Drugs plus emotional and physical trauma precipitate a disaster. Miguel, a 16-year-old gang member, was arrested and charged with attempted murder after he beat another teenager nearly to death. His gang claimed the color red. One evening, when he was in an intoxicated state from both alcohol and heavy marijuana usage, he approached a boy who was wearing a red sweater while walking his dog. Miguel asked, "What colors do you bang?" a reference to his gang affiliation. When the boy said he did not know what he was talking about, Miguel replied, "Wrong answer," and he hit and kicked the boy repeatedly until he was unconscious. Other gang members described pulling Miguel off the boy because once he started, he wouldn't stop. They were afraid he would kill the boy. The public defender ordered psychological testing on Miguel, which found frontal lobe dysfunction and evidence of ADD, depression, and learning disabilities. The psychologist suggested a SPECT series for independent verification. The scans were significantly abnormal. Both studies showed markedly increased activity in the anterior cingulate gyrus, consistent with problems in shifting attention. At rest, Miguel's SPECT study also showed mildly suppressed prefrontal cortex activity. While he was doing a concentration task, there was also marked suppression of the prefrontal cortex and both temporal lobes, consistent with ADHD, learning disabilities, and aggressive tendencies. Miguel was 8 years old when his mother was murdered. He subsequently had periods of depression and panic attacks. He had also suffered 3 concussions as a child. After these emotional and physical traumas, he started getting stuck on bad thoughts and troubled behaviors. Once he got a thought in his head, his father said, he would talk about it over and over. Miguel thought the substance abuse settled him down, but those close to him told me it made him more aggressive. Ultimately, the combination of Miguel's drug abuse, emotional trauma, and past concussions was nearly lethal to the boy whom he assaulted, and it ruined the lives of both the perpetrator and the victim. The saddest part of this case for me was that Miguel had a treatable brain, but no one thought about it until this terrible tragedy occurred. What happens when you stop abusing drugs or alcohol? One of the most common questions I get is about what happens to the brain when you stop abusing drugs or alcohol. It depends on many factors. What you used, inhalant seemed to be the worst, how long you used it, what your brain reserve was like before you started using drugs, your day-to-day other brain health habits, and your genetic vulnerability. Generally, the longer you abused substances, the more damage will be present. There are rare individuals who can abuse drugs for a long time before stopping, with few, if any, lasting ill effects. Others can incur brain damage after a very short period of time. In either case, the sooner you stop, the better chance your brain has to heal. If you are not using drugs, why does your brain look so bad? Another epiphany. At Amen Clinics, we often see those toxic-looking SPECT scans in patients who have no history of drug or alcohol abuse. The state of these brains has forced me to ask more questions about what may be happening to cause this. We consider things like the possibility of environmental toxins at work, anoxia, a lack of oxygen, infections like Lyme disease, carbon monoxide poisoning, chemotherapy, which poisons cancer and often normal cells, extremely low thyroid, or anemia. And when some of these factors are combined, watch out. The police might get involved because an individual's behavior can become very troubled. SPECT has taught me that there are many important missing links in understanding troubled behavior. Without knowledge of these links, people can be labeled as bad, willful, uncaring, or even possessed in some societies. Before imaging, it was easy for me to give someone a personality disorder diagnosis: borderline, antisocial, narcissistic, dependent, etc., thinking their personality or character was the problem. But as I began to look at my patients' brains, one simple question occurred to me again and again. What is the organ of personality? It's our brain. If someone has a difficult personality, their brain may be the cause, and there is a chance it could be improved, leaving them with a happier and healthier life. Infectious disease and the brain. One very common cause of scans that look toxic is an undiagnosed infectious disease like Lyme disease or HIV. Untreated, these infections can attack the brain and significantly affect one's ability to learn, love, and behave. Just like Adriana's story in Chapter 1, the normal 16-year-old who became psychotic after being bitten by a deer tick and got her sanity back after being treated with antibiotics. Many people with resistant psychiatric conditions such as anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and dementia have been exposed to infectious agents that damage their brains. In 1994, the Schizophrenia Bulletin published an image comparing the areas of the United States with the highest rates of Lyme disease and schizophrenia. They were nearly identical. The image was heralding a new era of infectious disease psychiatry, yet few knew it at the time. At Amen Clinics, we've treated hundreds of patients who came to us with resistant psychiatric symptoms, tested positive for Lyme disease, and were helped by treating it. A 2014 study reported that the antibiotic minocycline used to treat Lyme disease was found to decrease symptoms of schizophrenia in a 12-month period. Erin was a 9-year-old girl who came to see me for obsessive thoughts, anxiety, depression, tics, and academic problems. She had been treated with antidepressants, stimulants, and play therapy, which all seemed to make her worse. When she started to voice suicidal thoughts, her parents called us. Aaron's scan was strikingly overactive, indicating the possibility of inflammation. Something sinister was happening in her brain. Her lab studies showed that she had both Lyme disease and high antibodies to the strep bacteria. In the early 1990s, Dr. Sue Sweeto and colleagues at the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH, were studying obsessive-compulsive disorder and discovered that a percentage of OCD children had high antibodies to the strep bacteria, which improved with antibiotic treatment. They called this syndrome PANDAS, pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders associated with streptococcal infections. Until then, physicians knew strep infections caused rheumatic fever, which was associated with heart valve damage and abnormal physical movements. But Dr. Sweeto's discovery showed that strep could also cause psychiatric symptoms. We treated Erin for Lyme and PANDAS, and she had a remarkable recovery. Other infectious agents can also cause psychiatric illness. But if one never looks for them, they'll never find them. Toxoplasma gondii, or T. gondii, is a parasite found in cat feces and undercooked food. T. gondii infects just over 20% of the U.S. population. Most individuals infected aren't aware of the infection, but it is present in their brain and muscles. This parasite has been associated with psychiatric illness, including schizophrenia and suicide. Research estimates that approximately one-fifth of schizophrenia cases may be related to it. Gary Smith, M.A., Doctor of Philosophy, Professor of Population Biology and Epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Veterinary Medicine, wrote in Preventive Veterinary Medicine, "Thus, prevention of T. gondii infection during a lifetime may prevent one-fifth of cases of schizophrenia. That, to me, is significant." I believe infectious disease psychiatry will become a major discipline of psychiatry within the next 30 years. Think environmental toxins. Carolyn moved into a home that had been flooded in the recent past. Shortly after she and her family moved in, they started experiencing health issues. Carolyn began to suffer from skin rashes and numerous bouts of bronchitis, with her symptoms worsening over time. A therapist, she began to have trouble focusing and remembering details of her clients' lives. She often felt anxious and confused and had to quit working. Her oldest son went from being a straight-A student to getting C's and could no longer concentrate well enough to finish projects. A black belt in jiu-jitsu, he lost his coordination and couldn't participate in the sport. Her youngest son kept telling her that he couldn't focus or concentrate well enough to study at home, but when he would head over to a friend's house, he had no problem hitting the books. At home, it was also a struggle for him to get going in the morning, and he started racking up tardies at school. Whenever he spent the night at a friend's house, he popped out of bed with no problem and easily made it to school on time. By 2001, Carolyn knew there was something very wrong. One day, she saw a news feature about toxic mold on TV and suspected that it might be the problem. She immediately set up an appointment with an allergist, and she hired a mold inspector to check the house. The inspector's tests came back positive. Mold was the culprit. She and her family moved out of the house that year and never went back. Her children have mostly recovered, but it took Carolyn nearly a decade to return to work. Carolyn's story is very distressing, not only because of what happened to her family, but also because it could happen to anyone. Most of us go through life assuming that the products we use, the foods we eat, and the places we live are completely safe. As frightening as it may seem, a number of household items that we use on a regular basis, our favorite foods, and even our schools and workplaces could be poisoning our brains and bodies. Drinking from plastic water bottles, using insecticides in your garden, breathing in fumes as you fill up the gas tank, or working around noxious fumes in a hair or nail salon, or as a house painter, could be affecting your mental and physical health. Many occupations are considered high risk for exposure to environmental toxins. In my experience, brain scans of indoor painters show some of the highest levels of brain damage. Grounds maintenance workers work with insecticides, tree trimmers inhale dust, welders breathe in welding fumes, and hairstylists and nail technicians inhale product fumes. The risk to beauty salon workers has been documented in a recent study that showed that hairstylists have a higher than normal risk for Alzheimer's disease. One patient came to me because he was experiencing memory problems. I noticed he looked much older than his stated age. His scan showed scalloping, a sign of toxic exposure. He said he didn't drink or do drugs, so it had to be something else. When asked when his symptoms began, he said about 4 years ago, right around the time he bought a new car. After some investigation and a few trips to the mechanic, he discovered that the hoses weren't attached correctly to his car's engine. Every time he got into his car, carbon monoxide was pouring into the cabin. He was literally poisoning himself and his brain every time he drove somewhere. I once gave a lecture to 1,000 people at Skyline Church in San Diego. The next year, I was invited back. As often happens when I speak at a place for the second time, a number of people approached me as I walked into the lecture hall to show me spec scans they had done. My lecture motivated them to come to one of our clinics to have their own brain evaluated. On this occasion, a 35-year-old man named Todd came up to me to show me his scan. It looked like Swiss cheese, the same pattern we often see in our drug and alcohol abusers. As I looked at the scan, Todd said, "You think I'm a drug addict, don't you?" The thought had crossed my mind, I replied. "I have never used drugs," Todd said, "and I don't drink. Before I came to your clinic, I used to paint cars in my garage without much ventilation. I don't do that anymore." "That is a sign of intelligent life," I replied. "New information caused you to change your behavior." He went on to tell me that he and his wife had been in marital therapy for several years without benefit. After his visit to our clinic in Southern California, he started to live a brain-healthy life. The difference, he said, has been life-changing. After his brain health began to improve, he was able to be a better husband and had more cognitive clarity than he had in years. Being married is hard enough with a good brain. It's really hard with a troubled one. Medical causes of toxicity. At Amen Clinics, whenever we see a toxic scan in someone who is suffering, we always ask why. Here is a list of common reasons. Drugs or alcohol, infections, cancer chemotherapy, environmental toxins such as mold, carbon monoxide poisoning, lack of oxygen such as near drowning, hanging, strangulation, autoerotic asphyxiation, sleep apnea, infection such as Lyme, HIV, T. gondii, low thyroid, severe anemia, low red blood cell count, liver, kidney, or lung disease. Part 3. The Brain Warrior's Way. Chapter 19. The Amen Clinic's Program to Explode Your Potential, Reverse Illness, and Reduce Your Risk for Alzheimer's. As I was writing this chapter, one of my patients, Dr. Steve Arterburn, New York Times best-selling author, radio host, and entrepreneur, sent me this note and gave me permission to share it with you. My rental car confirmation number for Aruba was 6301-2078-US2, and hotel was 555-055-10931. The reason I know this is that I'm supernaturally able to remember things that I would never even try to before, and they don't go away. My productivity and creativity is off the chart. I would say I'm getting 4 times the work done, 4 times better than ever, and creativity has resulted in book ideas and proposals that I can't wait to publish. I have the ability to focus on tasks and connect with my wife in ways I have never experienced. Here is what I'm doing consistently. Exercising in bursts, as you suggested, versus 30 minutes of continuous running. No sodas versus 4 a day. Severely restricted sugar intake while increasing protein and reducing grains and processed carbs. Taking the supplements you recommended, CPAP machine every night versus never, Brain Warrior's Way exercises where I have a ways to go on memory and other areas, but in problem solving, I am up to the 99.5 percentile. Wow, what a difference. And the sexual intimacy is another amazing peak performance area. I know it sounds a bit difficult to believe all of this. Steve's experience is exactly why I do what I do. He is a brain warrior. The last step in the Amen Clinic's method is to live the brain warrior's way. It involves planting the strategies and tools in your daily life to explode your potential, reverse illnesses, such as depression and obesity, and prevent Alzheimer's disease and the untoward effects of aging. You are in a war for the health of your brain. Make no mistake, you are in a war for the health of your brain. Nearly everywhere you go, someone is trying to make money by offering you bad food that will kill you early. Food companies use neuroscience principles to develop addictive food-like substances that work on the pleasure centers of your brain, making you crave them. And then they use half-naked, beautiful women biting into burgers you know they would never eat to advertise them. If you are not a brain warrior, it is very easy for your weight to balloon out of control, which will shrink your brain. In addition, news channels repeatedly pour negative thoughts and horrific images into our minds by repeatedly showing us every bad thing that happens anywhere in the world. News corporations know that human beings pay attention to fearful news much more than they do to peaceful news. And electronics companies develop gadgets that hook our attention and decrease the time and intimacy we have with our loved ones. In addition, Alzheimer's disease is expected to triple in the next 30 years, and there is no cure on the horizon. 50% of people 85 years old and older will be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. To put this into perspective, if you are fortunate to live that long, you have a 50% risk of losing your mind as a reward. Frightening new research suggests that Alzheimer's disease actually starts in your brain decades before you have any symptoms. This finding means that a patient of mine who was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at 59 years old likely had noxious changes in her brain in her 20s. Depression is the most expensive medical illness on the planet and is one of the greatest killers of our time, affecting 50 million Americans at some point in their lives. Nearly all of us have either suffered from depression or know someone who has. My adopted son and my son-in-law had fathers who committed suicide. Depression is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, cancer, and obesity. An astonishing 23% of women between the ages of 40 and 60 are now taking antidepressants. Obesity is a serious national crisis, with two-thirds of Americans overweight and one-third obese. Obesity is the third leading cause of death and a risk factor for over 30 medical illnesses, including Alzheimer's disease, depression, and suicide. The answer in my mind to the epidemic problems of Alzheimer's disease, depression, and obesity is not to look for separate causes or cures for these problems, but rather to think of them as different expressions of the same unhealthy lifestyle that can only be solved by a brain warrior revolution in brain health. To show how these disorders are related, there are dozens of studies now, my team and I published two of them, that report As Your Weight Goes Up, the actual physical size and function of your brain go down. That should scare the fat off anyone. The obesity crisis is the biggest brain drain in our history. In our own studies at the Amen Clinics, we found that as your weight goes up, your ability to think and reason go down. This means that if someone doesn't get their weight under control, over time, it will become harder and harder for them to use their own good judgment to get healthy. The fat on your body is not just a storage place for excess calories. It produces toxic chemicals that promote inflammation and damage your brain. Losing weight is not just about vanity. It is important for your physical and mental health. When I first read these studies, I told myself I had to get healthy. I absolutely love being a husband, a father, and a grandfather.